It's just after 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and it's time for Animal Voices. And today, the Animal Voices Choir will be led by our friend, the Big Pig, because we are not only celebrating the Year of the Pig about to come, but we are going to be talking about pigs on today's show.
My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are co-host John Pranger and technician Alan Jensen. This show is produced through the cooperative efforts of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Ideas expressed on this program are not necessarily supported by these groups. At the top of the show today, we'll be speaking with Vicki Burns of the Winnipeg Humane Society. And she will be telling us about an important development towards improving the lives of the domestic pig, especially in Canada. Now, this is a very appropriate topic. As Alan has already mentioned, we're into the Year of the Pig. So I'd like to wish you Happy New Year. Gung Hei Fat Choi from Animal Voices. John Pranger will have various topics he will be presenting, including new developments in engineering food at the molecular level, known as nanotechnology. Now, we're wondering if this may be worse than GM food, which we were all pretty much concerned about. Now, I believe our first guest, Vicki Burns, is on the line. Hello, Vicki.
Hello.
Oh, nice to have you on the show, Vicki.
Yes, it's nice to be here.
We're looking forward to hearing about the improvement that is coming up, at least, for the pig. Now, maybe we could first, though, just talk a little bit about the animal itself, the pig. I think it's a very, very commendable animal. I've been told a very intelligent one that is often maligned. We use such expressions, oh, he's dirty as a pig, and such things, and then from what I've heard from farmers, they are not dirty animals, given the opportunity to stay clean. Can you tell us something about the characteristics of the animal?
Well, I can try to tell you a little bit. Certainly, they are considered to be very intelligent animals. There was some research done at the University of Pennsylvania, for example, where they actually taught the pigs quite easily to use a computer to select different alternatives in their living situation. So that's just an example of how intelligent they are. Certainly the stereotype about pigs being dirty is because one of the ways that they like to clean themselves is to actually roll in the mud. And so, you know, that would end up making them look dirty. But I mean, they really, if they have the choice, they absolutely like to have a separate area for sleeping, a separate area for eating, and they have their dunging area quite far removed from that. Unfortunately, in most of the factory type barns where pigs are raised these days, they don't have much choice as far as being able to separate those functions.
Yes, I'm sure that is the case. Factory farms are always overcrowded.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about pigs is they are quite social animals. They do like to live in groups. They definitely you know, they don't like to be isolated from each other. So in lots of the farms that we're trying to promote as the good way of raising pigs, they have, for example, 25 or even 50 sows living together in one area. And as long as they have enough space and they have straw to root in, they're able to live harmoniously together.
What about the young ones? Would they be separated? Or I guess it would be, if you had 50 sows together, there would be a danger, wouldn't there, to the young ones?
But yes, well, usually in any situation, when you have a sow that's about to give birth, usually she would be removed to an area that they would reserve for what they call farrowing. That's the term you use when pigs give birth.
I see.
And in the really progressive farms, they have, how to describe it, kind of little areas where it is one big common area, but there's a separate little box that the sow can go into where she has her own sort of private nest and can have her babies in there. And for the first 10 days or so, the babies would just stay in that area. And then once they're a little bit older, the sow and the mother can join the group. But until they're at least 10 days old, they're a little too vulnerable to be with all those other animals.
I see. Now, this is totally different, isn't it, in a factory farm?
Well, yes, and the systems that we and many other people across North America have been trying to get rid of, we call them intensive confinement systems. And what those, for pigs, what that means is it's a system of stalls. The stall that the female pig lives in while she's pregnant is called a gestation stall, because it's for the period of her pregnancy or her gestation.
And how long would that be?
Well, that's just over 4 months. That's how long a pig pregnancy lasts. Then when she's about a week or so before she's due to give birth, she's moved from the gestation stall into another stall that's basically the same size, and it's called a farrowing stall. The only difference is that it has room outside the stall along both sides. It has room for the little piglets. So the mother pig would give birth in that stall, and then she would remain there with her piglets for about maybe 2 weeks or at the most 3 weeks, and then the piglets are weaned from her, and they're moved off to a separate pen, and she's moved back into the gestation stall. And it's amazing how quickly she would be impregnated again, usually within a couple of weeks.
Oh, what a sad life.
Yes, so for the female, the adult female pigs, once they turn about 6 months old, that's when they're old enough to breed. They're moved into the stall system, and they basically live in that stall until they're pulled out to be slaughtered. And just to make sure that your listeners understand, the stall is so small that the pig cannot even turn around. With difficulty, she can lie down, but otherwise, all she can do is take a step, maybe one step forward and one step backwards. And she has to live her entire life in that small space, including eating, sleeping, defecating. You know, it's very, very terrible confinement.
It
so
is.
We're thrilled that the Smithfield Foods in the United States and now Maple Leaf Foods in Canada have announced that they're going to phase out using those systems. So that's tremendously positive news.
Now, and when are they going to do that?
Well, they're giving their producers 10 years to make that change. We certainly hope that they'll make the change a lot sooner, but we understand that it's not going to happen overnight. But it is tremendous news that they finally have made an announcement that they're going to get rid of all those stalls, the gestation stalls anyway, not the farrowing, but the gestation stalls have to be gone within the next 10 years. So,
what will replace them? Do you have any idea, or does anybody?
Well, right now there are a couple of alternatives, and one of the alternatives that we're really pushing is what we call straw-based group housing. Now, there's several different types of barns that you could use for that, but first of all, because pigs are very social animals, it is important for them to be in groups. Not in groups of 1,000, that's way too many, but in groups of, you know, 25 to 50 sows with straw. It's terribly important that they have straw, because pigs instinctively want to root in something, and if you don't give them something to root in, they don't have anything to occupy their day with, and so that's when there's more of a chance of fighting. So really, there's several systems. There's in Manitoba, we have something called biotech shelters, which are kind of hoop-shaped barns that are not very expensive to put up, and the heat that is used is basically generated from having pigs in a lot of straw in a in this sort of hoop-shaped barn that keeps the body heat keeping the place warm. So those are very economical, and that's something that's being promoted. Then there's kind of the old-fashioned type of barns, you know, just the barn that you might imagine seeing by the side of the road that has, you know, a couple of different pens in it with straw. One of the big things the industry is struggling with is how to make sure that they're able to provide feed to the animals in a way that doesn't promote one of the, you know, stronger sows bullying the other ones and eating too much of the feed. So there's some different systems that they're going to have to use for that. But there already are farmers, and there always have been farmers across Canada who have used the group housing type system. So I think we really just need to look to how they've done it successfully.
They're using far fewer pigs, are they not?
That's true. And yes, you won't find, I think it would be very rare to find those type of farms that have thousands of pigs under one roof. But, you know, the reality is I think we're going to have to not raise as many animals, and the farmers are going to have to get more per animal. So for those people who are still eating pork, I think you should be prepared to pay more.
Mm. And the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has recently released a report. Can you say anything about that?
About is that the report that talks about the greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes.
Well, that's something that I haven't studied that report closely, but it's becoming much more widely recognized now that animal agriculture is a very, very big contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, in the province of Manitoba, where I am, it's now recognized that the animals that we're raising for food are contributing more than 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions in this province, and that actually that percentage has increased tremendously over the last decade, because in Manitoba the number of pigs that we are raising has gone up by 300% in the last decade. So I think what's going to happen now is people are going to recognize that we simply cannot be expecting to raise as many animals. We're probably going to have to eat a little less meat, and we're probably going to have to pay quite a bit more per pound of meat in order to compensate farmers and in order to make sure that we're not damaging the environment at the same time.
We may be improving the health of the humans in the country at the same time if we do that.
Absolutely.
Cut down on some of the obesity.
Yeah.
We are a huge producer, aren't we, of pork. I see 1.6 million sows in crates across Canada. That's a huge number.
It is a huge number. I think, I don't know what position Canada has in terms of pork production in the world. I think it is fairly significant, and certainly the province of Manitoba has one of the greatest numbers. I think between Manitoba and Quebec, we have the highest number of pigs. Out in BC, I think you guys don't have quite as many. You have a lot more chickens.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, working on that issue too out here.
If a picture is worth a thousand words in your newsletter, there's a picture of these pigs in the in the crates. I guess they're not farrowing crates, but the breeding crates. It's worse than any prison you've ever seen or heard of for human beings, that's for sure. And yet these are all innocent animals just being exploited ruthlessly, it seems to me, by people who are only interested in money.
Well, you know, I think one thing we have to keep in mind is these systems started 40 or 50 years ago, and they started around the same time as it was recognized that if you gave animals a tiny bit of antibiotic in their feed, they would grow a lot faster. And also, if you gave animals a little bit of antibiotic in their feed, that would help prevent some of the illnesses which you would normally expect to happen when you're cramming so many animals into such a small space. So I personally don't look at the producers who are doing it this way right now as bad people. I think they've grown up with this system thinking it was the only way to do it. But really, now that it's become much better known that this is happening, I'm so grateful that so many of the public object to it, because it is absolutely inhumane to keep any animal so confined for its entire life that it can't even turn around. I can't find a single justification for doing that. So I'm certainly very grateful that there are so many other people who have made their voices be known to the corporations that are actually selling this kind of meat, and that's what's created this change, I think.
Yeah, and the change has been made in the U.S., hasn't it?
Well, the Smithfield Foods only made their announcement about 5 days before Maple Leaf Foods did. So the advance in the United States was that Burger King and McDonald's had announced that they were going to only buy from farms that had better animal welfare standards than the normal. They had not yet said they were not going to use gestation stalls. So the other thing in the states that happened is that two of the states, Arizona and Florida, were able to have referendums in which the entire population was allowed to vote on the issue. And in both of those states, there was clearly a great majority who felt that the intensive confinement system should be banned. So
that's very symbolic of
what happens when the public really finds out about these things.
Right. That's great. And you have done a lot of work, haven't you, in the Winnipeg Humane Society to push this issue?
Well, we have. There's quite a group of people here who are very, very passionate about it. And about 3 or 4 years ago, we actually had a life-size sow created by some fine art students. She's very realistic looking. And we bought a real gestation stall from the company that makes them here. And the reason we did that was because we then take that display, which is the actual size of a real pig and a real gestation stall, and we've taken it around to various malls and any public location that we can. And it's amazing the reaction you get from people when you can actually show them what you're talking about. It's much clearer and has so much more impact than just hearing the words.
And it sticks in the mind better, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure that that's part of why we've been able to be part of the group that helped this change come about.
Well, most people couldn't imagine the kind of horrors that these animals are subjected to, so most of us don't have those kinds of images in our head or can even think of them as possible until we actually see them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've started to realize that there's a good reason why a lot of the factory-type barns are kept closed to the public and to the media. You don't very often see images on the news of chickens in battery cages or pigs in gestation stalls, because I think the industry knows that the general public will react to that. And in my view, whenever we're trying to hide an image of something, that's very telling. Why are we trying to hide the image, you know? So
yes.
I think we need to ask a lot of questions when industries are not willing to open up their doors and show what they're doing with animals.
Yeah, and it's easy for them to do it in a country like Canada where we have space and the city people are pretty well excluded completely from what goes on in the farms.
Yeah.
More so than in, say, a place like Britain. Where
that's
much
true.
Closer. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Can we get back to the emissions again, the environmental problems caused by livestock emissions? We don't hear anybody saying these things. 30% is an enormous quantity. So, but we don't hear this.
Quantity, and you know, I think the reason why you haven't heard people saying it yet is because it's really a pretty recently recognized fact. At least it's only recently come to light. In fact, in our main paper in Winnipeg yesterday, the Winnipeg Free Press, there was an excellent editorial piece where all these facts and figures were given, but that's the very first that we've seen of that in our Winnipeg paper. So
I think
you're going to hear a lot about it in the next year or two, particularly since the general public has suddenly acquired so much more interest in the climate change and greenhouse gas emissions.
And our politicians, they're really moving fast, aren't they?
Yes, thank goodness.
Yeah. Now,
can't be too fast, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either, but I would wish that the David Suzuki Foundation would take this up. There's not the slightest mention of it. And it's certainly easier for Canadians to become more vegetarian, if there's such a thing as being more vegetarian than... Then getting out of their cars, because that's nobody's going to do that.
Well, I think maybe now is the time to start saying to people, it's not going to hurt you to have one or two less meals a week that include meat.
Absolutely.
It's perfectly healthy, perfectly possible to remain very healthy with eating very little meat or no meat at all. So
yes, and many people have gone cold turkey, including Tolstoy.
Oh, okay.
Yes, one night's conversation convinced him forever.
Really?
With a friend, yes.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Now, Al Gore's movie doesn't mention it, so there's another inconvenient truth coming along, folks.
Yeah.
And that is that our habits, our dinner table habits, are coming to haunt us.
Yes, that's a very good point. I think we will see a lot more talk about this in the next decade, or in the next year, actually, not the next decade. I think we're going to see it in the next year.
I'm sure that your group will continue pushing, won't you, on the issue of mistreatment of the pigs?
Oh, absolutely. And we'll also, now that we've made some serious progress with pigs, we'll start working on the chicken issue a lot more than we've ever have before. So.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, one tack of that is the avian flu, of course. And I see that the buildings that are now going up for more chicken farming are even larger than the ones that have caused all the trouble.
Really?
So far, yes. Someone told me that in his travels throughout BC, he's seen these barns go up, and they're several stories high.
Oh my gosh! Uh oh. Well, I think the idea of raising thousands of animals under one small roof is really going to just continue to create tremendous problems. And I really think we'll see a huge change in that in the next decade, because there's going to be more and more recognition of the various problems.
Yes, I think one of the big ones is the antibiotics fed to these animals. And as a result, just as in human hospitals, superbugs develop when you feed every patient an antibiotic in order to prevent him getting one of these communicable diseases in the hospitals.
Yes, so the antibiotic-resistant issue, I think we're going to see more information about that as well. There's no question about that. Yeah. And the amount of antibiotics that are used in animal agriculture are going to come under a lot closer scrutiny.
And it is huge, isn't it? Just a
it
huge
is
percentage.
Huge, and it's completely uncontrolled. That's the thing that really shocks a lot of people, there's no control on it. You could actually just go to your local feed store and buy a whole bunch of antibiotics.
Oh, that's interesting. That right? I didn't know that. I would have thought the veterinarian would have to write out a prescription.
No, it doesn't have to be. That's what I mean about being uncontrolled. So it's hard to even say how much is being used.
It is
an area that's really going to be looked at seriously again. That's another one of my predictions.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh. Well, this has been most interesting. Now, I'm sure people would like to know more about this issue and maybe about your own organization, the Winnipeg Humane Society. Could you give us a website, perhaps?
Yes, sure. Our website is www.winnipeghumanesociety.ca. Just as it sounds. And we do have a section on farm animal issues and lots of other information about our Humane Society. So please, feel free to check it out. And we also have links to other good organizations that have excellent information, including the Vancouver Humane Society.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That's my organization.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Vicki, for being with us this afternoon. And congratulations on your accomplishment.
Well, thank you very much, and it was very good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Vicki Burns of the Winnipeg Humane Society. Now,
Before we go, we had somebody calling in who wanted to make a different point about the use of pigs and the way the Canadian military is using them. And this person may hopefully still be in the line. Just a second. Are you still on the line, caller?
Yeah, indeed I am.
Oh, thanks a lot for waiting, but because we were talking about...
What I heard this morning is just absolutely beyond and gives me less and less hope in humanity. It's just, it's horrendous.
So, I just left you waiting for a few minutes because we were talking about animal agriculture, but
that's
what
right.
You were talking about is quite different, so perhaps you can just
give
us...
Well, it's not really different because it's an industry as well as the army is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the using of animals for such a purpose is just atrocity.
Can you give us some details about...
Used as an anecdote in CBC and in the morning show. I just tuned in a little bit too late, so I didn't know what this whole thing was all about. Anyway, there's a tool for in teaching medics in the Canadian Army. Pigs are used as a tool. Let's put it this way: they shoot the pig about 15 times from the AKA in the face, and make the medic to keep this pig alive as long as possible. If she survives certain amount of hours, they shoot the pig another 6 times. And make this medic keep this pig alive as long as possible. If that's not enough, if the pig survives this, they put the pig on fire. If she survives this as well. So they keep the pigs about 15 hours alive in pain like this.
Yeah, that's been going on for years with no conclusion in sight.
You support our troops, right?
Oh, you've heard about this, John, too, have you?
Oh, yeah.
Using pigs like this? I've never heard of this.
Say
using pigs as targets then, so the medics can train on them.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
Sometimes they have the pigs just hanging from a stick by its forelegs tied, and then they shoot it at random. They're such cowards, these people. And yet, this all goes on quite in secret because, of course, the Army divulges very little, and you can hardly get any information. But that it being so protected and secretive, anything goes. So it's been going on for years, and they've never, ever achieved any satisfactory conclusion.
Well, you have to
it's all fraud.
What people are going to army, you know, the people who just voluntarily want to just shoot other people that will shoot anything. So that was only about pigs, and I can bet that happens to dogs and cats as well.
Oh, yes, it does. Yeah, all sorts of animals are used. Monkeys are used in radiation experiments and atom bomb experiments and whatnot. Animals are incredibly abused. They're set on fire, and nothing is ever accomplished by this method except that it misleads medicine into all sorts of byways and blind alleys and swamps.
Yeah, the only thing it does is feeds the sick ego of people who are doing this.
Yes, and you know, the morality of these people comes down to the street level eventually, doesn't it? And look at the corruption around us.
Well,
it's such an immoral society we live in.
I repeated this, what I heard today, but you know, it's just, I can't get over this, what I heard today.
Yeah,
I know those things are happening all the time. But, you know, you hear this one more time, and it's just, you say, it's enough of it.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's all scientific fraud. Go ahead.
Thanks for calling in, caller, because I'd never heard of this before myself, and it's very good. Maybe other people who are listening to the CBC picked up on that, but I've never heard that the military uses animals in such a gross way. And so it's good that we're aware of that. So thanks for calling in.
On our website, animalvoices.org, /ADAV, or use the link at the top of the page, which is to the Anti-Vivisection Society, you'll find an article there on Army use of animals.
Okay, so we're going to take a little musical break now. We have to keep in mind that pigs are our friends, and they're great animals, and we can all celebrate pigs for the next year because the year of the pig is imminent, but we're going to hear a song that doesn't have anything to do with pigs, but it's a lovely piece of song, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. in the big rock candy mountains. All the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-goin' to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the big rock candy mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the big rock candy mountains.
Oh, thank you. Now, just to show that we humans are not all bad, I want to give a more upbeat story about a wonderful lady who lives in Mission. Her name is Carol Hine, and I found this out through a friend who gave me a copy of a December issue of the Vancouver Sun, and this is an article written by Nicholas Reed with pictures and so forth. But I just want to tell you about saints. And the word saint stands for the Senior Animals in Need Today Society. Senior Animals in Need Today Society. And what this lady does is it's taking animals who are abandoned, pretty much, I would say, and cares for them in the last few months of their lives. And she has quite a variety. Let me just read a little bit. It's called a pet hospice near Mission. I hate the idea that an animal who has lived its whole life in the service of humankind should die in a concrete cell somewhere, she says. I can't imagine anything crueler than that. So this is a chance to make their last days on Earth a little happier. That's the least I can do for them. And so she takes in a variety of animals, including cats, dogs, donkeys, and various others. And they have a very pleasant life. She has acreage that they are allowed to roam on. A llama is another, a pot-bellied pig, sheep, horses, etc. And they live out there and until they're, you know, brilliant terminal. They're very terminal, and then I guess at least some of them get put down. But I thought, well, there's a really, really kind lady, and she is a nurse herself and does work in a hospice. And perhaps one day we'll get Carol Hine on our program. Isn't that lovely to think that somebody is kind enough to do that for old animals who are no longer wanted by the people who have been their companions earlier lives? Now, John, I think you have something.
Yes, the only gods and the only devils on this planet is the human race. Mm-hmm. And that is a saint, and there's someone who goes by the name of saint, but who isn't actually, and to me is a big phony, and that is Peter Singer, who is the animal rights guru that everybody looks up to so much. But in fact, he's nothing but an employee of the Rockefeller Foundation and of the establishment in general. And I want to read you an article from The Observer of Sunday, November 26, 2006, by Robin McKee, who is the science editor of The Observer. And it goes like this. One of the most important figures in the animal rights movement that has publicly backed the use of living creatures in medical experiments. The endorsement by the philosopher Peter Singer, who coined the phrase animal liberation, and whose 70s book on the subject led to the creation of the animal rights movement, has surprised observers. Singer, professor of bioethics at Princeton, is renowned for insisting animals should have equal rights with humans, but is quoted on camera backing research in which experiments on monkeys are carried out to develop surgery for Parkinson's and other Parkinson's patients and other patients. And he's quoted as saying, it is clear that at least some animal research does have benefits. Of course, he doesn't say which or how much or anything, but it leaves the door open for a vast expansion of animal research, if you ask me. Singer admitted on a documentary by the BBC, too, called Monkeys, Rats, and Me, Animal Testing. And he goes on to say, I would certainly not say that no animal research could be justified, and the case you have given sounds like one that is justified. This admission has delighted scientists, including the Oxford surgeon Tipu Aziz, the doctor involved in this work. It is a very encouraging sign, he said. The BBC Two documentary focuses on animal rights activists' battle to block the building of the £20 million Oxford University Animal Laboratory. Construction was abandoned in 2004 after a campaign of intimidation led builders to pull out of the project. Work resumes this year. The program, the most thorough TV examination of this vexed subject, includes graphic footage of electrodes being drilled into the skull of a rat, which is later put down on camera by lethal injection. Well, they often break their necks, too, so it was a big show for the camera. There is also footage of a monkey being prepared for a similar experiment. But viewers will also see a young Scottish boy, Sean Gardner, crippled by the movement's disease, dystonia, taking his first tentative steps from his wheelchair after similar surgery involving electrodes being drilled into his skull. The documentary is being screened as the battle over the Oxford laboratory reaches fresh intensity, with a new group of opponents announcing it will hold its first public meetings in October in Oxford on Tuesday. The Voice for Ethical Research at Oxford, VRO, has been set up by university staff and students opposed to animal experiments and is backed by senior politicians, including Tony Benn and Anne Widdecombe. VRO has been launched to counter the highly successful pro-laboratory group protest created by 17-year-old student Laurie Pycroft last February. Protest capitalized on local people's weariness of the laboratory's hardline opponents, led by the animal liberation group Speak, whose members gather near the site to scream abuse at workers. Last week, Sharon Howe, VRO's founder, admitted that many local people had become alerted by the hardline anti-vivisectionists. The debate is so polarized it is impossible to have a sensible discussion. We want greater efforts to be made in developing alternatives to animal experiments. And that's the old line again. I mean, as if there were never enough. But there are more than 400 scientific methods which replace or make animal research completely redundant, which it has always been, of course. Never been of any use. Anyway, this article goes on to say, in addition, the Wetherall Committee, set up by scientific organizations that included the Royal Society and Wellcome Trust, in other words, vivisectors or animal experimenters, completely dedicated to their science and to the fraud by Wellcome Trust, will publish the results of its investigation into the use of primates in university and other academic labs, and their conclusion was that it's absolutely necessary. Several thousand primates, mostly macaques and marmosets, are experimented on every year to discover how neurons connect with the eye, to find out how images form in the brain, and to make other basic scientific discoveries. Of course, they can't relate them to human beings, and so the whole thing is quite a useless thing. The committee, chaired by the Oxford geneticist Sir David Wetherall, was asked to investigate this highly contentious subject and decide whether this science is sound and relevant to humans. According to sources close to the committee, the report, which will be published on 13 December, will back the continued use of primates for this sort of research. Wetherall has concluded it is good science and that it is relevant. Well, I'd like to... That's the end of the article, and I'll just quote Mark Twain from his biography when he says, or his autobiography, rather. And he says, of all the creatures that were made, man is the most detestable. Of the entire brood, he is the only one, the solitary one, that possesses malice. That is the basest of all instincts, passions, vices, the most hateful. He is the only creature that has pain for sport, knowing it to be pain. Also, in all the list, he is the only creature that has a nasty mind. Well, I feel quite chastised, but of course he's talking about you, not me.
You would count on it, John.
A little music, or?
I wanted to actually make a point, too. Yeah. It's good to, I think, keep in mind sometimes that the animals around us aren't simply the domestic animals that we are using for experiments or using for food. And a lot of the items that we do in this show really deal with the way people directly use animals in those ways. But most of the animals in the world are wild animals. And one of the most important considerations we have at this point in history is that of conservation, wildlife conservation. The wild animals are species of wild animals are disappearing right, left, and center all around us. And it's mainly because of habitat removal, but it's also for other reasons, like we've all heard about what's...
Pollution.
Yeah, pollution and what's happening through global warming, like to polar bears and other animals in the Arctic. And other animals all over the world, whether it's oceans warming up or coral reefs disappearing and so on. It's a
overfishing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a huge and you may have heard about the plight of the albatrosses through longline fishing in the South Pacific. They fish for tuna with lines with hooks in the end, and they put small fish on the hooks to catch the big tuna. But the birds go after these things and they get caught on the hooks. Oh. And the albatross, there's several species of albatross that are on the verge of extinction now because they're getting caught up in these longline fishing things, mainly for tuna for Japan. And but if people who go to a Japanese restaurant here and have tuna sushi, they're probably getting tuna from the same situation, because most of the tuna is coming from long line fishing. And
so if it's dolphin free, that's not necessarily
to say that
it's in any way humane.
The plight of the albatross is much more serious than for the dolphins. Like I said, there are several species of albatross that, like, their populations have dropped by something like 90% just in the last few years because of this, because this fishing industry is huge, because tuna's worth so much money. You know, in Japan, one tuna is worth, you know, thousands of dollars, right? Yeah. A big tuna.
Yeah, these blue pins. Yeah. Huge.
So I wanted to make a point about a local conservation issue, and that is the Vancouver Island marmot. Now, probably many people, probably you two in here, and many people in British Columbia aren't aware that one of the world's most endangered species lives in Vancouver Island, and it's a marmot. Mm-hmm. There are four species of marmots in Canada, and three of them are, you know, you see if you go to Whistler or up to the Rockies or whatever. But the fourth species, the Vancouver Island marmot, nowadays is only found in south and central Vancouver Island, high in the mountains, and it's almost disappeared. I think the present population there are 60 marmots in the wild right now, and that's it for this whole species, right? And there's been a really good program going on by conservationists in Vancouver Island for several years now. And what they're doing is they're raising marmots in captivity. After a lot of research, they've become successful at raising them in captivity and then reintroducing them to the wild. Mm-hmm. And so last year, they were able to put 15 marmots back into the wild. And they're surviving the marmots. Training them or keeping them in captivity in such a way that they learn to eat and interact with other marmots in a natural way, so to speak. So when they're released, they can just fit into the environment. And they've even opened up a couple of areas that used to have marmots, but they've gone extinct in those areas, and they're reintroducing the marmots to some of these areas.
What has caused them to go extinct in those
areas?
Oh,
logging. It's clear cut logging, and it so disrupts the environment that kind of removes their home, and then they clear cut log it, and all the soil gets washed away, and their environment is just totally degraded.
Totally.
And
they haven't been able to escape from these devastations.
They're up in hills, right? And they can't go down the hill because it's just not their environment. They're basically a high altitude animal, and the forest companies have in some areas in Vancouver Island logged right to the top of the hills, and so there's no place for the marmots to go.
Well, they leave a splintered earth.
Yeah. So fortunately, the forest companies have agreed to leave a few small little postage stamp size areas, so this small population of marmots can continue to exist in Vancouver Island. I mean, it's a real positive situation, the fact that these people who are working with the marmots in Vancouver Island have been able to start reversing this tendency. Because when they started, there was only, like, I think 30 in the wild, and now they've got 60 in the wild, and they have 143 at this point in time in captivity that they're breeding and preparing to introduce them out into the wild as well. So the total population is over 200 now, which is a huge increase. It's kind of a situation like the whooping crane. Like, they were down to about 25 or 30 birds about 20 years ago, and now they're back up to about 200 birds and maybe more than 200 now in the wild. And so with proper conservation
reforestation, I think, is really important, isn't it?
It's going to take reforestation or leaving other areas where they could introduce the marmots that are still pristine, so to speak. And it's a matter of, like, the BC government is not very conservation minded, and so they haven't really done anything in terms of
pro industry all the way.
Yeah, right. And so it's like the whole fish farm thing all over. Like, their priority is the logging companies, and it isn't, even though this is one of the world's most endangered species. It really is. You know, out of all the thousands of species of mammals in the world, this is one of the most endangered, and it's right there in Vancouver Island, like maybe 50 miles from the BC legislature. Right?
But why should anybody care about a little guinea pig? That's what people think. Yeah. You know, what niche, what role does it have to play? How important is it? Or what's the big deal?
What these people are, one of the things they're trying to do, which would be great if they could do it, is get the government to make the marmot the mascot of the Olympics. Mm. And of course, it'll probably be their white bear, right? The Komodo bear, which is what they're, people love bears, and they say, and it's such a
romantic,
soft, cuddly thing that they can use. But the government hasn't decided yet what the mascot's going to be, and so they're hoping they can convince the government to do that. If you want information about the Vancouver Island marmots, it's very simple. It's just www.marmots.org. And if you just go www.marmots.org, you can get into the Vancouver Island Marmot Foundation and get more information about what they're doing and so on. And they're virtually totally supported by donations from people, right? From just ordinary citizens. They don't have any big money coming from anywhere, right?
And you got a newsletter there, do you?
I do have. It's called the Marmoteer. Marmoteer. They're pretty good. They're pretty good at doing their publicity and stuff. Yeah, and they put together this little newsletter. I've been supporting them for about 4 or 5 years myself, and so I've been regularly getting these newsletters. So for at least for several years, they've been producing this newsletter, the Marmoteer, that they send about twice a year, and they send other stuff during the year as well.
That is a word for guinea pig, is it not? Marmot or
no? A marmot is not a guinea pig. It's a totally different family of animal. A marmot's probably closer related to rabbits than guinea pig is somewhere else.
Or groundhog?
It's closely related to a groundhog. One of the local marmots is a Whistler. Whistler Mountain is named after the marmot, the Whistler Marmot.
That's where the name comes from. Great story there.
Yeah, that's the habitat of that marmot, which is the hoary marmot, I think. The hoary marmot's also known as the whistling marmot or the Whistler, and it lives throughout the Rockies and Coast Range Mountains and is found as far north as Alaska. Then there's the yellow-bellied marmot, and they're pretty common. If you go up the interior, up in the hills anywhere, often you'll see yellow-bellied marmots, and you can see the yellow belly on them. And then the woodchuck, also known as the groundhog, is a marmot also. And those are the three marmots you find in Canada, along with the Vancouver Island marmot, which is the other three have healthy populations because they're widespread. Whereas, I guess, after the last glacial age, the Vancouver Island marmot ended up being isolated in southern Vancouver Island and has sort of never escaped from there, and it was doing fine until about 50 years ago. And
it adapted to mountainside.
Fairly high
habitat.
They're all of them are mountain creatures, basically. Like,
so you know, they don't dig holes for their homes because that's pretty shallow earth, isn't it?
They tend to live in crevices, like they like rocky mountains where there's lots of crevices and things to get into. And if you see them, like up in the interior of Canada or up around Whistler, you'll see them. If they see you, they'll disappear into a crevice in the rock, right? Mm. Often you'll see them up sitting on top of the rock, kind of watching, and they kind of watch what goes on. They're fairly big animal. They're the size of a beaver, maybe, almost. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're big. They're fairly sizable.
And they're vegetarians?
Yeah.
Are they distinctive from the others? If you saw one of the from the other areas, would these ones be distinctive in some way?
Yeah, well, these ones are quite dark brown with sort of a white nose. And the yellow bellied is it's a lighter color and definitely has a distinctive yellow belly. Mm-hmm. And so They are identifiable. They're quite distinct. They are distinct species. They're the same family. They're all marmots, but they're quite distinct species.
They could interbreed.
No, they cannot. They are distinct species.
They're all marmots, but.
They're not subspecies. They are distinct species of animals. That's what I'm saying. There are four species in Canada. It's like, you know, like robins and crows and gulls are just species of birds, right? They're all birds, but I mean, and so the marmots are all in the same family, but they are different species. I think worldwide there's something like 15 or 16 species of marmots. So, like, they're found in the Himalayas and other parts of the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Anyway, I thought I would update you on the Van Camp and make sure that people realize that in our own backyard we have one of the world's rarest animals, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and one that is most threatened.
It is what?
That is most threatened or has been most threatened.
Yes, indeed. Oh, yeah. Like, it would be extinct now if these people in Vancouver Island had not started working a few years ago and perceiving the problem and, sort of getting the logging companies to at least, you know, give a few acres of land that they'd leave aside for these things and then starting this program of breeding and reintroducing them.
Great. Well, I'm for your wish for your wish for it as a matter. Mascot for the Olympic Games.
It'd be one good thing that came out of the Olympics, right?
Yeah.
Nothing else good will come out of it, but if it was, then people would hear about it and become well known, and there'd be money, easy to raise money to protect
That's true. Do you have something, John?
Yes, the uselessness of animal experimentation to test drugs is once more brought home for us, with the FDA strengthening its warnings on the controversial antibiotic KTEC, and has banned the drugs used for treatment of sinusitis and bronchitis. This new move follows a year-long FDA investigation into the drug's side effects. And the FDA has determined that the balance of benefits and risks for KTEC do not support continued approval of KTEC for these generally non-serious and often self-limited illnesses, said Dr. John Jenkins, director of the agency's Office of New Drugs. The use of the drug will still be permitted for pneumonia. The FDA investigation began after a scandal broke out over severe liver complications that led to the deaths of five KTEC patients. The death sparked a Senate Finance Committee investigation into whether the faulty data and fraud were used in the FDA's approval process for the drug. Under the FDA's new rules, KTEC will carry a black box warning against its use by patients with the neuromuscular disorder myasthenia gravis, or gravis. The black box warning, so-called because of the thick black border used to make it stand out, is the strongest warning that the FDA can put on a drug. Any stronger concern about a drug's safety requires that it be banned. Even before the new rules, KTEC already carried a bold warning about possible liver damage. Stronger warnings have now been added about other possible side effects, including blurred vision and loss of consciousness. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, who headed the Senate investigation, has been highly critical of the FDA's approval of the drug, expressed satisfaction with the new rules. When the spotlight was turned on the questionable way in which Ketek got approved, the FDA was held accountable, he said. But not everyone is convinced that the new rules go far enough. A black box warning is the FDA's way of justifying the continued sale of dangerous drugs that should probably be pulled from the marketplace, said Mike Adams, author of a book called Natural Health Solutions. Every time the FDA can no longer refute the evidence that a particular drug is extremely dangerous to the public, it resorts to using the black box warning to deflect attention from the fact that the drug should probably be banned. It's a tactical ploy used to maximize big pharma profits, which seem to be the FDA's primary mission now. Well, I think it has been for some time.
Thanks very much for that, John. Yes. I think we are just about out of time.
Yes, and we didn't do As We Program, which is an article on nanotechnology, but maybe we'll get to it
soon. Next week. Good. But thank you all for listening to Animal Voices, and we will be back at CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial next Friday at 12 noon. Please tune in.
Go Edge.